Hey, everybody. I'm David Greene, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm here with our regular crew, Sarah Isger. She's senior editor at The Dispatch. She is a lawyer. She was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. And Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, was communications director for the DNC and also advised Hillary Clinton. And we're going to dig right in because fighting in Gaza resumed this week after that temporary agreement allowed the exchange of hostages between Israel and Hamas. That deal ended with Israel alleging that Hamas violated the pause in fighting. And we should say that throughout this conflict, I mean, we've seen heated arguments at our own dinner tables, really. We've seen strained friendships. We've seen hard conversations, including right here on this show. We've seen protests that have erupted across the United States from campus squares to city centers and also on Capitol Hill. Protesters have been marching for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, as well as for Palestine's right to exist, and arguing against Zionism, which is the ideology affirming the Jewish people's right to self-determination and a Jewish state. Protests on college campuses and a rise in anti-Semitic incidents were much of the focus on Capitol Hill over this past week, and that's where we want to zoom in a bit here, that the House passed legislation condemning the drastic rise of anti-Semitism globally and here in the U.S. This measure passed by a vote of 311 to 14. Many lawmakers just voted present, and that really highlighted a divide among House Democrats. While condemning anti-Semitism, some Democrats saw a line in this measure stating that anti-Zionism was in line with anti-Semitism. They saw that as a step too far. And Mo, Sarah, this is where I want to start. I mean, lawmakers spent a lot of time talking about this, and I'm wondering, what do you see as the purpose? I mean, there's a lot of important work that members of Congress could be doing in terms of how to handle and confront what's happening right now between Israel and Hamas. Do you see some important purpose in holding lawmakers' feet to the fire and saying, do you or do you not agree that anti-Zionism equates to anti-Semitism, Sarah?
I saw a great deal of purpose in having, for instance, the three university presidents testify before Congress from Harvard, MIT, and Penn, because their testimony was so egregious. Sort of universally condemned from the White House to Democrats in Congress to obviously those on the right. At the same time, you had these students telling us about their experience on the Hill that same day, Penn, Harvard, and MIT students. And it was breathtaking, right? Swastikas, gassed the Jews, assaulted in the library, not to mention just the ubiquity of the anti-Semitism that they're facing just to walk through the quad or to get to lunch. And yet the university professors, it was both their tone, the substance, the smirking. I mean, the question was, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate your campus's policy? This is the video that made the rounds. And each one smirked and said, well, it would depend on the context. It was a wild answer for a few reasons, right? As some people pointed out, legally speaking, under the First Amendment, the context does matter. But on these campuses, you've got two problems. One, they do have policies. They're not enforcing them. That's a huge problem. This happens, you know, every time these students protest without sort of the permit that they're required to have or the school permission and all, you know, where they're protesting and disrupting class. All of the things that have been enforced in the past are no longer being enforced. You've got a policy problem on the one hand. But you've also got just a deeper problem, I think, which is these university presidents who have now all walked this back, issued apology videos that don't actually apologize. They clearly thought what they were saying was, it not only was okay, but if they had been in their faculty lounge, everyone would have been like, yeah, totally. Yeah, it does depend on the context when you're talking about genocide of Jews. The fact that they were sort of met with the reality of the American people, that was concerning to me. And so are there going to be consequences for that sort of thing? That is the purpose of a congressional hearing, by the way, is to shine light oftentimes. I felt like they did shine the light. And now the question is, will there be consequences in the sense of, will parents think twice about the value of a Harvard degree, for instance? Will the, you know, has the progressive movement lost all credibility when it comes to speeches, violence, believe all women, these sort of things moving forward? Will they ever be able to get back to any moral clarity on any of that in the next situation that might require it? And lastly, of course, will there be actual consequences from Congress when it comes to tying federal funding to enforcing some of these policies? Title VI, for instance, which says that if you have created a hostile school educational environment that is severe and pervasive due to a student's real or perceived religion, you violated federal law and you'll lose federal funding.
But can I, before we get to punishing universities for what you're seeing here, I just, because I think this is actually related to the question I brought up to the top about, is anti-Zionism the same as anti-Semitism? These like gotcha moments of forcing people in leadership and otherwise to say a certain thing in a given moment, I kind of hate it all. And I feel like it is modeling the kind of behavior that we are trying to avoid in society right now, which is like, let me ask this question and be really aggressive about it and force you to say the right thing. I mean, I think it's awful. And it's members of Congress who are doing the very thing that we're trying to avoid at our dinner tables. Now, to get to what to the point that you just brought up, like, you're a lawyer. And I guess I saw those presidents. Yes, they should have said and answered the question that Elise Stefanik, the Republican lawmaker, was asking about whether saying you support the genocide of Jews is consistent with your code of conduct on campus. They should have spent 95% of their answer saying that statement is horrific. It should not be excused ever. But in addition, their policies, and this is where I want to ask you as a lawyer, rely on certain things to be true. And there's a difference between someone saying something, you know, in open air, walking across the quad, and rising to the level of violating the code of conduct, depending on who it was said against, who heard it, the specific behavior. And I thought it was fair for them to bring that up, because we don't we want rules to be specific and apply to certain situations?
So two things about that. First, let me just say on the gotcha questions, maybe the genocide question was closer to the gotcha line, and I'm sympathetic to your point. But for instance, when the president of Harvard University was asked, did you fly the Ukrainian flag on campus last year? She refused to answer that question. Right? That's not a gotcha question. That's just a, like, you know the answer to that question, and she didn't want to answer it because Fair. She knew where it was going to head. So not all of it was gotcha questions by any stretch. On the genocide question itself, this is why a bunch of free speech folks online, for instance, were like, look, exactly what you said, right, David? Like, you may not like the answer, but in truth, that is what the First Amendment requires. Few problems. One, of course, these universities have been very clear that they are not bound by the First Amendment, which is why they have been able to punish students in the past for their speech and faculty members. You are correct that the policies, as they are written, legally matter, but they are not the end of the discussion, because if you don't apply the policies consistently, you are just as liable for violating Title VI. In fact, it's usually used as evidence against you that you had this policy that you simply didn't enforce against anyone else, but you selectively enforce when it comes to, for instance, anti-Jewish speech.
Well, let me bring you in here.
The only upside of this whole terribly depressing episode is it's nice to see some of my friends on the right come around to where the left has been for a very long time, and that there is no such thing as free speech absolutism. That this whole notion of cancel culture versus consequence culture, the right is willing to adopt far more than they are willing to admit. And this is a perfect case, and they are right to. They are absolutely right to push for consequence culture in this case, and to demand a certain level of consequence for the idiotic statements by these university professors. And so, look, what
can I just push back on that just a little, which is, I'm not sure that the right wants consequence culture. I think they want equal treatment. If you're going to do one, you have to do the other, or don't do both. I mean, I still am a free speech absolutist, but you don't get to pick when you're a free speech absolutist, depending on what the person is saying.
You know, most of the people on the right who are weighing in on this issue are not calling for equal treatment. They are being absolute that there should be consequences for this horrific statement. And I don't disagree with them on that.
The horrific statement being, if you were to say that you support genocide against the Jews, that
last week we spent a lot of time on this show talking about how a lot of life is lived in the gray zone, that there are a few blacks and whites.
Right.
Being anti-genocide to me is one of those purely fairly easy to determine black and white issues. And anybody who tries to dance around that in the name of academics or whatever, I think is they're just way off base.
Which is why they should have said anyone who says that should face consequences. But they were going into the legalese of their code of conduct policy.
Sarah is so right. If somebody were to march across a college campus chanting white supremacist statements, most universities would take action. When I work on a college campus, we have had incidents of white supremacist literature being graffiti on campus, and the university takes swift action when that happens. When there is clear hate being spread, a university does have right. It is not inconsistent with a university's moral obligation to providing a public square where many perspectives are shared. These are not inconsistent ideals. And it just reminds me how, while so much of this particular issue, Israel and Gaza, is complicated and lives in the gray and how we put an end to the conflict, what really pisses me off more than anything is how people are trying to draw lines, force people to take sides where you actually don't have to.
Yes.
You are allowed to be pro-Palestine and anti-Hamas. And what I get frustrated when people whose position I share in wanting to see a free Palestine someday, a Palestinian state someday, allow themselves to be defined by Hamas when they dismiss Hamas's atrocities in order to make a broader point about a Palestinian state. Hamas's atrocities are making it more complicated to get there. I get equally upset when I see people who try to make the point or try to argue that any criticism of the Israeli government and its policies is anti-Semitic, is anti-Semitism. Those things aren't true either. You can be pro-Zionist, you can be pro-Israel, and anti the Netanyahu government and how it's litigating this war. You can even be, God forbid we accept this fact, you can actually be pro-Palestine and pro-Israel.
Absolutely. This is why I was so pissed off. You want to talk about being pissed off by the language in that resolution, because there's no space for me. I mean, I consider myself a Jewish person who is not anti-Semitic, but who is anti-Zionist. My understanding of Zionism...
Define your Zionism. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, my understanding of Zionism is not just reflecting respect for the existence of a Jewish state, but embodied in that was that it was right to drive and displace Palestinians from their lands. I believe there was a version of that, if we look decades ago, that there could have been the existence of a Jewish state elsewhere that did not require people to be displaced. So I consider myself today, based on that understanding of history and accepting that, to be anti-Zionist, but not anti-Semitic. I am also pro Israel. I believe that Israel should exist, but I don't believe in the philosophy that led to where we are today. And I certainly don't condone the behavior of the Israeli government right now in how they've handled this conflict against Hamas. So there's a lot of nuance there. There's a lot of gray for me. And there's no place for me in a resolution that says anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is the same
thing. Some of the most,
there's just no place.
There are members of Congress who are strongly identify as Jewish who took your position on this,
yeah.
Right? Who stood up against this resolution because they said we're conflating too many things. And what's happening here, in a sense, is the problem that we see in all of our politics today. It's easy. It's easier to, you know, they're looking at the statements of one or two people or of a fringe minority and trying to apply it to an entire side, to an entire movement. And that's wrong, right? This resolution was a reaction to some pretty idiotic things said by some members of Congress, by some members of the squad or what have you, or the Progressive Caucus, or what have you. And that shouldn't define or drive the entire conversation.
Right.
Right? Congresswoman Jayapal, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for on so many issues.
Pramila Jayapal, yeah.
Head of the Progressive Caucus, completely flubbed a response over the weekend on why more progressives aren't standing up and speaking out against Hamas weaponizing rape. You know what? Most progressives are standing up and speaking out against anybody and everybody who weaponizes rape. But trying to turn it into a both sides issue, saying, you know what? We should speak out against this, but it shouldn't. We can also speak out against it. Like, you know what? This is an easy one. We're against Hamas for weaponizing rape, for using rape as a weapon, full stop. You want to then talk about Israel? Bring that up in the next conversation, because it's going to come up.
I want to pick up right here, but we're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll continue this conversation. When we come back, we'll be right back with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, you are listening to Left, Right, and Center during KCRW's season of giving back, and we should say that KCRW and shows like Left, Right, and Center are funded by you, our listeners. That's right. We rely on the public for most of our consistent form of support. So if you like what you hear and what we're doing here, please make a donation today by going to kcrw.com/give.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Okay, we're back with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Greene. Moa Lathy's here. Sarah Isger's here. We were talking about what we've been seeing play out on Capitol Hill as it relates to this conflict between Israel and Hamas. Mo, you brought up Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, how she condemned the sexual violence that was committed by Hamas, but also called for balance in bringing in the outrages against Palestinians, and then this led to a lot of pressure from her colleagues to come back and reiterate exactly what was going on in her mind. You were saying that she should have just said sexual violence committed by Hamas is horrific, full stop, and not tried to balance.
That's
things.
Exactly right. That to me is it's that one. There's a lot of moral clarity around, and by then trying to make it more of a political argument, you lose a lot of the moral clarity that I think she has, and I think she was trying to communicate. It is totally legitimate to have outrage over how Israel and the Netanyahu government is litigating this war. It is totally legitimate to have outrage looking at all of the destruction and death being rained down on Palestinian civilians. But there's no reason when the conversation turns to sexual violence being perpetrated by Hamas to muddy those waters. Have the moral clarity of the position and move on.
I guess
Can I offer two proposals?
Yeah, Sarah, go ahead.
I want to see what you guys think about this. So, David, first, on the Zionism resolution.
Yeah.
If they had simply cut out the word anti-Zionism and said, people who believe that the state of Israel should not exist is the same as anti-Semitism. Would that have been clarifying for you? Because I think that's what they meant by anti-Zionism. And that's what a lot of people mean when they say they're anti-Zionist, that there should not be a Jewish state. They argue that having an ethnocentric state or a religious state is somehow immoral, of course, ignoring, I don't know, China, which is practices Han supremacy, literally every country in the world except for the United States, which has an official religion, not every single one, but most, the vast, vast majority. But they treat Israel separately. And that's what I think they meant by anti-Zionism as anti-Semitism. But I agree with you, define your terms then, because you clearly define anti-Zionism as a historical matter quite differently. My second proposal, which is more for Mo, and I don't know that I totally agree with this, but I want to raise the specter, if you will. What if a university had a policy that said that within an academic setting, be it classroom or you're out to lunch with your professor, you know, the sort of hallmarks of learning, if you will, free speech absolutism. You want to make the case for white supremacy or anti-trans stuff or anti-Semitism or whatever that is. Ask the questions in class, press those issues. Let's, you know, let it get to the truth through an adversarial process, which is how we've said is the best way we know as humans to get to the truth. But have a code of civility outside of that academic process, which can take into account these things that we're talking about, Mo, which is, you know, not scrawling a swastika on the dorm room of the Jewish kid and writing "gas the Jews." Obviously, assault would be against any university policy regardless. What about that balance? As a free speech absolutist, I'd at least be interested in a university that wanted to pursue something like that.
I'll answer your first question quickly, and then Mo, I can let you take up Sarah's second question. That would have been a distinction to me that would have been important, because I believe, as I sit here today, in the existence of a Jewish state and the existence of Israel. To say otherwise goes down a very dangerous road that could be considered anti-Semitic, because you're basically saying this country, this society should not exist. And I, as a Jewish American, would never say that. What bothers me about the term Zionism is it implies that displacing people from their lands was justified and required. And that's where I struggle, especially as I watch what is happening in Gaza right now, with people being, you know, I mean, going through unimaginable terror and being displaced from their lands. So that would have been an important distinction for me. And that's
great. I solved the congressional resolution. Mo, did I solve academia?
Here's what I want. I want to see moral clarity speaking out against anti-Semitism without making it about Israeli politics. And I want to see moral clarity speaking out against Islamophobia and the rise in anti-Arab discrimination and acts. We just saw three Palestinian college students shot in Vermont, essentially for walking down the street wearing a traditional Palestinian scarf. Now, on your point about academia, look, I work at a university, but I don't speak for academia. I will say, in my mind, I think you raise an interesting question, Sarah. There is a difference in my mind about an interesting academic exploration on a college campus versus activism on a college campus. There's room for both. But you want to sit in a college classroom or in the student lounge at the end of the night and debate some of these issues. That's one thing, and very different than walking across campus holding up a banner. And so that distinction on a college campus between activism and academic exploration, I think, is important. Sometimes that line can get very, very blurry. But I do think you raise an interesting point in raising that question.
I think we need to move on. I really appreciate both of you engaging in that. It feels so important. And what we saw play out on the Hill, I think, was worth talking about. But I want to move for a few minutes to check in on, you know, this thing called a presidential election that we have coming up in less than a year. We're a little over a month away from the Iowa caucuses. They're coming on January 15th. And, you know, in case anyone hasn't heard, Donald Trump still has a very commanding lead in the GOP race. Commanding, but maybe not insurmountable. The rest of the field, which has thinned a lot since the first GOP primary debate about 5 months ago, kept up their efforts to chip away at that lead with the fourth Republican debate this week. It was hosted by News Nation. I don't think that many people were able to tune in or did tune in, but still felt like it came at a critical moment. Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy all took the stage hoping to convince voters that they should be the one to fill the Trump-sized gap as the party is looking to take back the White House. We're also about a month and a half away from the New Hampshire primary. That's January 23rd. That date, all five Republicans will be on the ballot, as well as one Democrat, Dean Phillips. Joe Biden's going to be absent from the ballot that day, but Democrats in the state are pushing for a write-in campaign. Mo, I want to go to you because you were texting with me and with Sarah and with our team here saying that you played a role in basically killing the New Hampshire primary for the Democratic Party. And I'm wondering what you meant by that, well, and what actually happened here.
Let me be clear about what happened there, because the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee, which I which I serve on, a year and a half ago began a process to rethink the primary calendar. This was before any candidates formally declared, because we just kind of felt that the traditional calendar wasn't best representing the party. And so we opened it up and gave other states a chance to make a pitch to go in the early window, which has traditionally been filled with Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and Nevada, and to rethink the ordering of these states. Because we wanted to elevate certain new, different voices. We thought it was well past time that Iowa and New Hampshire had such an outsized influence over selecting the Democratic nominee. And so we opened it up. We came up with a plan that put South Carolina first, kept New Hampshire in its historic role, second in the nation, but asked it to share that date with Nevada. There's an important point here, which is that, and the Supreme Court has upheld this time and time again, states don't get to choose how parties select their nominees. Parties choose how they select their nominees.
Don't tell New Hampshire and Iowa that, but yeah, sure.
but the process by which nominees are selected are solely the responsibility of the parties, right, not the states. So the DNC came up with rules. New Hampshire said, we can't move our primary. That is false. They actually could. They were not bound by what the Secretary of State said. They could have held a party-run primary, which many other states do, but they chose not to. And because they chose not to follow the rules, there is no Democratic primary in New Hampshire this year.
It's going to happen, but the party's not going to recognize it?
It doesn't count. It's a beauty contest. It's essentially a straw poll, and the president's name isn't even going to be on the ballot because he's following the party's rules.
And you don't think this will damage Biden at all if people start saying, like, oh, New Hampshire happened, Biden didn't. I don't know. I mean, I could just see this going badly somehow.
I guess I don't see that, because the rules were pretty clear. Joe Biden's adhering to those rules. Other candidates are not. So they're going to spend a lot of money on a contest in which they won't get any delegates. And that's how you select a nominee, is by racking up delegates.
So you're telling Democrats in New Hampshire, nothing you do matters. You should just focus on the larger race here.
Come to the Republican primary and actually make it count.
Okay.
What we're saying is that the New Hampshire Democratic Party could have made this all work. They chose not to. And so as a result, New Hampshire Democrats are going to not have a chance to have their voice heard in a primary. Sarah's right.
Yes, Some of them might vote in a Republican primary.
Come to the Republican primary and do what? I mean,
stop Donald Trump if you want.
Stop Donald
Trump.
And well, that,
I'm not
that's
gonna
my
tell people how to vote.
That's an interesting question, though. Like, let's say a bunch of New Hampshire Democrats, you know, make some news by rushing over and supporting Nikki Haley and gets her a nice bump, and, you know, who knows, even beats Trump. I'm not saying that's likely, but getting a bunch of Democrats excited about Nikki Haley, is that good for Joe Biden, Mo?
Well, I
I'll
think
tell you
what's
not good for is probably Nikki Haley.
Yeah, which we're already seeing. I mean, DeSantis is hammering her for basically being a Democrat
in disguise. The problem will be that if Nikki Haley doesn't perform particularly well in Iowa, you know, she does fine, but doesn't come that close to Trump, and then comes very close or overtakes Trump in New Hampshire, the Trump team will say that it was because of Democratic voters, whether it was or wasn't.
But let's play in the real world here for a second. What Democrats do isn't really an issue. What independents do really is. Because in New Hampshire, if you're, you know, if you're an independent, you can walk in and choose either ballot.
If you're a registered Democrat in New Hampshire, you can't walk into the Republican primary? Is that, or you can? Sarah, I see you like Googling. Are you literally researching New Hampshire primary rules as we speak?
So New Hampshire state law is a semi-closed primary, meaning that a voter generally must be registered as a party member in order to participate in that primary.
Right, that's what I thought.
Primary. But an unaffiliated voter can participate in the primary of his or her choice, and someone who is registered can change pretty close to election day. So if you're a registered Democrat, I would need to go look up the actual date, but like you could probably go this week and switch your party registration to just unaffiliated. And then,
right.
Yeah.
Here's the backfire that I'm talking about, Mo. This is like, I remember Pennsylvania, all these Democrats re-registering as Republicans to be able to vote for Donald Trump in the primary in a Democratic field where a lot of Democrats aren't so excited about their president and his re-election, like in offering them the chance in an early primary like this to go re-register and vote for a Republican in the primary, that just, it feels a little
It doesn't happen. It makes for great media intrigue, but it's not a real thing that happens.
Okay.
What's going to happen is one of two things. There's going to be some Democrats who are frustrated will go and write the president's name in, even though it won't count. More likely what's going to happen is that independents, these unaffiliated voters who have by law the ability to vote in either primary, are going to walk in and pull a Republican ballot and cast a vote. And my guess is most of those people will not vote for Donald Trump, which probably accounts for why Nikki Haley and Chris Christie have a better shot at winning the New Hampshire primary. What is not going to happen is a large number of Democrats walking in, changing an entire lifetime of voting history and habits, switching their party affiliation in order to vote for the other party and then switching back.
Okay. Well, we saw some re-registering for Trump. And yes, update me.
For all of our New Hampshire listeners.
And then we got to move on. Yes.
The deadline for changing your party affiliation passed. It was October 6th of this year.
Well, great. Well, this conversation was still very useful, I would argue, to frame what's happening in New Hampshire and Iowa. And we're going to have to leave it there. And Sarah and Mo and I are going to come back in just a few minutes. We're going to talk about banned books in Florida. Get ready. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
All right, before you take a break, I do want to say that we are in the midst of KCRW's pledge drive, and we would love you to support the station that you love. We want to make something clear. There are a lot of people who don't have the means to contribute to KCRW. There is no judgment, no guilt about that. But if you are able to give, please give whatever you can. We're suggesting maybe $20 a month if you're able to do that. Anything you give actually gets you a lot of member benefits for a year, including coming to members-only events, a lot of great music. So please support us any way you can. Go to kcrw.com/give. Again, that's kcrw.com/give.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could bring a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah Isger is here, senior editor at The Dispatch. Mo Alethi is here, executive director at Georgetown's Institute of Politics and Public Service. And we want to turn to another installment of our 50 States series. This is our way of zooming in on a single state. We're trying to hit all 50 before next year's presidential election and finding some takeaways that we can get from stories at the local level that we might not be paying close enough attention to or really understanding in a deeper and more nuanced way. And we're going to turn today to Florida. There are two school districts in the state that are facing federal lawsuits over the removal of books from public school libraries. You know, we know book banning has been a hot topic in Florida and across the country, but people in Florida and others with an eye on these cases say that the lawsuits get to some bigger questions that are worth exploring. And we have Jeff Solacek here. He's an education reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. He's been covering education in the state of Florida since the mid-90s. And Jeff, thanks for taking a little time for us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So as I understand it, there's a real question here that's come up in these lawsuits about whether public school libraries are a forum for government speech versus a forum for free expression. That all makes me so curious. I mean, can you help us sort of just understand what those phrases mean and what's really at stake in these cases you've been following?
Well, the argument comes from our attorney general, who entered a friend of the court brief. She wasn't even, the state wasn't being really involved in the lawsuit as a participant. And her argument is that these are government schools and we take things out and put things into schools all the time. These are a place for the government to decide what goes in and what doesn't go into schools, into the libraries, into the curriculum. They make decisions like this all the time. And so that is the sort of idea of a forum of government speech, as opposed to a forum of freedom of expression, which is, can somebody just go in and say, I want this here, I want that there. I can say what I want and do what I want in this space because it's a public space, it's a public school. And it really just lit up. The filing came out 4 months ago, but it really just lit up in the past couple of days when people started seeing the actual language that they were trying to basically say, you know, we're in charge here and the schools will be what we want them to be.
And what is the argument on the other side? People who are suing these school districts and saying that they do not have the right to decide what books go into libraries and which don't.
Well, I don't think anybody's saying that they don't have the right to decide what's there, but I think what they're trying to argue is that there's a critical point where it looks like you're trying to silence certain viewpoints and remove certain items from the libraries that present a specific point of view. In a lot of cases right now, the books that are being removed refer to LGBTQ issues. A lot of them do. And so one of the points is that, you know, by the government restricting what children in the schools can have access to, they're denying their free speech First Amendment rights.
And I wonder, I mean, what has the reaction been among people who live in these communities?
Well, I haven't been to those particular communities where the lawsuit is taking place, but I've been in other parts of the state where they're having similar arguments. And what you see is just an across-the-board everything perspective. You have everybody from the, yeah, take those books out, to the, no, don't take any books out, and you can't decide for me, I'm the parent. And this parent right thing that we've been talking about a lot really comes into play because one person will say, I'm trying to do what's right for myself as a parent, and I don't want you to tell me what to do. And other people say, I don't want the government to tell me what to do. And it all just gets wrapped up in this, it gets wrapped around the axle, and you hear it from all sides.
And when you say parent rights, what do you mean by that? And what role do parents believe they should be playing in debates like this?
Florida has the parental rights in education law, which has been on the books now for a couple of years, and it's been reformed over time. Part of it was what some people referred to as the Don't Say Gay law, which is, you know, a branding issue. But that whole idea of, can you talk about or do instruction on gender identity and sexual orientation? Can you tell things in schools about a variety of different things and subject matters? And what happens is that you have some parents who are arguing that, you know, parents are in control, not the schools. We don't co-parent with the government. And we want to make sure that we are in complete control. And the legislature has made it so that parents have increasingly more control over what goes on in the schools, and the school districts have to really work more closely with the parents. And so all of these conversations come up in the realm of, I don't want this for my child. I don't want that for my child. Or I don't want you deciding for me what I have to do with my children. You decide for yourself and yourself only.
All right. Jeff Solacek is an education reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. Jeff, great talking to you. We really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, I listened to Jeff there. Sarah, you and I have been kind of texting back and forth with Motu about this question. And it's interesting to dig into this from a purely legal place and to try and set aside some of the politics. But I guess that's where the real challenge is with this issue. I mean, you had me nerding out on Supreme Court decisions. I went back and read this 1982 case, Island Trees Union Free School District versus PICO, which was a school system in the state of New York. And it really did establish, you know, the right that Jeff was talking about, that school systems do have the legal power to decide what goes into libraries and what don't, period. But it says that they can't use that discretion to, like, narrowly or from a partisan standpoint, you know, control what ideas are expressed based on their own politics. And that's that feels like an unresolved legal question that's been around clearly for decades, but one that is just sort of bubbling up again right now in our society.
Can I throw in another wrench into your
PICO
analysis?
Throw many wrenches. Yeah.
PICO didn't have a majority opinion. So there actually was no decision from the Supreme Court in that case. It was a plurality. They couldn't get five justices all on board. So it's just been unresolved since 1982, exactly where the law is on that. You know, when we talked about this, I told you guys that I didn't want to talk about it.
You
and
did.
Then my explanation for why I didn't want to talk about it, you guys were like, no, that, let's talk about why you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, because you were like, there's too much nuance and there's it's easy to conflate. And I was like, let's help people not conflate. Let's help people understand
yes.
this.
And my point was, there's this policy question that I don't find interesting in the sense that, like, it'll differ from school district to school district, what specific books should be in the school library. That's just too granular a question, including curriculum. You know, there was a school district, I forget which state, whether it was Oregon or Washington, but they banned the teaching of To Kill a Mockingbird because of its, you know, sort of white supremacy overtones and like white savior stuff. You know, I want my kids to read To Kill a Mockingbird, but you can't read them all, you know, like you do have to make some choices of what we're going to read and what we're not going to read.
But if a school system has a policy of like getting rid of anything that has to do with, for example, you know, like trans culture, I mean, that would feel like it's not that boring. That would be a policy that I would really have a problem with. I mean, so it's not always a boring policy question.
Well, no. So that this is the most granular question is literally what books should be included.
Right.
Rising up from that, there's the who gets to decide what books are included. I think that should be voters. So yeah, if your school district's saying they're going to ban this whole type of book, the voters should probably get a say in that and vote out those school board members. That's one way we could decide. I don't know how else we'd be able to decide that question. Courts can't come in and say this genre of books must be included. The only way they're going to get involved is when a school district basically tries to take away a genre of books and they say, no, you have to have all genre. I mean, right? That opinion gets kind of weird. By the way, I would love to use the example that was the case in the PICO case. Remember, this is 1982, there was a junior high involved in the lawsuit as well, and the book that they wanted to remove from the junior high school. And remember, this is like seventh graders, was Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. You know, the one about eating kids?
Mm.
First of all, this idea that the junior high kids were just flooding the library, requesting to read the 1759 or whatever Jonathan Swift essay is ridiculous. So oftentimes, it is also important to remember, this is really parents fighting amongst each other. There's not usually actually a crisis with the kids. And then the third one, of course, is then legally what the First Amendment and what our laws say about all of this subject. And yeah, the Supreme Court's plurality decisions in PICO get weird because you see the Supreme Court grappling with the same thing. And it's exactly what you said, David, which is not fine. Like, we can't go book by book and the Supreme Court's not going to weigh in on A Modest Proposal per se. But if you're trying to remove an entire class of books, is there a right to information in that forum different than just pure government speech?
Mo, I'm going to let you take us home here.
I think this is such an interesting legal conversation. But I don't think that's what's happening in Florida right now. I don't think it is a legal conversation. I think, you know, they're using the law to try to make a point. But would Florida's attorney general have filed the same brief if it was a progressive school district banning the Bible from a school library? My guess is they probably wouldn't be weighing in the way that they're weighing in on this. This is a political agenda that is being pushed by a government administration that has sort of, you know, found some political capital in this agenda.
But most of my point, the lawsuit that's happening in Keeping Out to Kill a Mockingbird, I agree that both sides have a political agenda when it comes to removing books from the curriculum. But our job is to decide then what the rules should be.
You're right.
Like, look, conversation.
No, you and I and this show. Yes. We will decide for everybody.
It's good. It feels like we're about to come to solve the problems here.
Look, this Sarah's right in the sense that I think all of this is going to be litigated at the ballot box, in school board elections. Florida is such an interesting case because the governor has sort of used a heavy hand, removing school officials, removing prosecutors around the state, removing folks in government that do not share his agenda, penalizing university officials who do not share his agenda. It sort of amplifies the bigger issue, but this is being now fought district by district at the ballot box with in elections with individual school board members. I just think that the case being made by the attorney general, that the brief that they filed was fairly cynical because they would not have filed that brief if it was on the other side of the ideological divide.
All right. Can we agree that
a modest proposal should be mandatory reading for all seventh graders? Because obviously they're clamoring to read it. Since 1982, they've wanted to read it, Mo.
You're just full of proposals today. You're just solving all the problems.
I think we should ban that book from junior highs, A, because it was never being checked out in the first place. But also, we don't want to warn the kids that we're trying to eat them. Right? Don't give them the heads up.
Okay. I think it's time to move on. Yeah.
We are going to have to leave it there. And we are going to move on to our left, right, and center rants and raves before we wrap up. Who wants to go first?
Double rant.
Great.
Double rant. We saw a debate, the latest debate, as we talked about earlier this week, between the four remaining non-Trumpian candidates in the GOP field.
Ramaswamy's and a little Trumpy. I just want to say, go ahead.
Ramaswamy took it to his Trumpiness to a whole new level this week when he went on a rant filled with a bunch of I don't even want to call them right wing conspiracy because there's no ideology behind these conspiracy theories. In one answer, he pushed the argument that January 6th was a government inside job. He pushed the argument once again that the 2020 election was stolen. And he pushed the argument of a great replacement theory, which, of course, is an argument that has been used time and time again by white supremacists and by those who commit acts of mass violence. None of those things are true. And here we have a quote unquote leading candidate for president on a national stage, pushing them all as if they were fact. That's rant number one. Rant number two, the moderators let him do it. There was literally no pushback, not even a nudge back that any of this was not true. They just let him push all these arguments and move on to the next question. We have to do better. We have to push back on these very dangerous lies when they're seeping into the mainstream of our political discourse. And that is a role that journalists can play.
All right, Sarah.
So mine's a rave and a little bit of a bougie one. But there's this TV that is basically digital artwork. Like, it shows artwork when you're not watching TV. And we often think of, you know, when something becomes mass media or mainstream, it loses its like artistic value. But at the same time, it allows that artwork to reach more people. And there is something so cool about this technology that allows one to stare at a Van Gogh in their house that obviously you'd never have a 3-foot Van Gogh in your house otherwise. And I'm a big fan of not having TVs all over my house. This has been a source of contention between me and the husband, who would like more TVs in the house. But we compromised and now have this art TV in our house. And so I spend this podcast staring at the most beautiful Van Gogh. And it's this beautiful field with little red poppies in it. So much joy. And sometimes I think whether you're like an engineer or a lawyer, you know, when you're in the weeds on something, this is actually the purpose of art. It is to pull us out and remember the beautiful and divine. And anyway, my rave is for beauty.
I love that. So with that, I want to thank you, Sarah, and you, Mo. I want to thank Mark K. Green, who is the producer of this show and brings us all together and does all the work each week. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Thank you for being here as always, and hope you come back next week. We'll have more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.